Hello and welcome to Volume 36 of Capital Ideas Live. Today we'll examine the attitudes toward property rights that are emerging around the world. We'll discuss global competition in the softwood market. A little closer to home, we'll look at New Forest products, agrotourism, and how to make a timber sale. I'm Hayes Brown, the General Counsel for the Alabama Forest Owners Association, and I'll be your host for today's discussion. Our first guest is the editor of the Americas column for the Wall Street Journal. She's Mary O'Grady. Welcome, Ms. O'Grady.
Thank you.
Your column recently reported on how different countries regard political and economic freedom. Is that generally right?
Yeah, actually what I wrote about it on January 9th was our findings for the release of the 2004 Index of Economic Freedom. We co-published this with the Heritage Foundation in Washington. This is the 10th year of the survey, and we look at 156 countries around the world, and we look at a number of different factors measuring economic freedom and try to boil down their level of economic freedom to one number, which is, you know, no small task, but that's basically what the survey is about.
Since you mentioned the index, that apparently there's a process of quantifying what is meant by freedom. How do you go about doing that?
Well, we use 10 factors, and I'll just run through those factors very quickly. We look at trade policy, how open an economy is to imports, the fiscal burden of government, which is a measure of taxation and spending, government intervention in the economy, which basically looks at actual government ownerships of state-owned enterprises, monetary policy, which is really an inflation measurement, capital flows and foreign investment, how free capital markets are, banking and finance, wages and prices, property rights, regulation, and informal market activity, which is to say we look at the black market and try to draw some conclusions about how much black market activity there is, and that's usually a reflection of the level of economic freedom in a country.
Mm-hmm. Property rights are one of those issues you mentioned. What are some of the trends that you're seeing around the world?
Well, in a sense, all of these things are property rights. I mean, they all tell us how free we are and how much the government intervenes. But the category that we call property rights refers more specifically to really respect for actual, property itself. Like, for example, regulation is a category, and a very highly regulated economy infringes on property rights. But the property rights factor measures, you know, how much the actual ownership is respected, and things like eminent domain and seizures and confiscation of property by governments. And in this category, we are seeing a disturbing trend. I mean, we feel that property rights are not well respected, and it's one of the reasons why the developing world is having so much trouble getting traction. I write a lot about Latin America, and there we have a very big problem with property rights. But we also are concerned about property rights in the United States.
There is a trend toward exploring areas like Latin America to grow timber, but would there be some cautions in moving into those kind of countries to try to grow a timber, which is a long-term resource?
Well, I mean, I think that a number of governments in Latin America are still having trouble establishing the longer-term traditions that we have here of strong property rights. The most obvious one more recently is Venezuela, where there's actually been confiscation, expropriation of farmland because the current government feels that that's in the best interests of the popular will. So that's an example of a place where property rights are very insecure right now. And I suppose at the other end of the spectrum, you would have Chile, which has a fairly good track record in this. But if I can, just for a minute, I'll mention that, you know, the United States has a very strong history of property rights and, you know, a tradition that they're respected. And yet, this year in the index, we make the note that uncompensated government expropriations of property remain highly unlikely, but local governments' abuse of eminent domain power with the seizure of private land and then we say parenthetically, with some compensation, and its transfer to another party for a non-public or quasi-public use has become more common, despite some legal challenges to that practice. So even here in the U.S., it's something that remains always at the risk of the political whim. And so if it's at risk in the U.S., I would say that you just have to raise the bar even a little higher in Latin America.
Okay. Thank you, Ms. O'Grady. We appreciate it. Ms. O'Grady spoke of several countries in the regard for property rights, and now we'd like to expand our focus to the entire world markets. And here to help us do that is Dr. Al Schuler with the U.S. Forest Service. Hello, Dr. Schuler.
Hello, Wayne.
You've been studying the global competition in the softwood markets. Could you just tell us a little bit about what you're seeing?
Okay. What we're seeing mostly in with the softwood markets is just too much supply. If you look at, I think last year, the U.S. imported almost 40% of its softwood lumber. Now, the bulk of it comes from Canada, but we also import a fair amount of industrial lumber from South America, Brazil, Chile, and also from New Zealand and Australia to a certain extent. And last year, we imported a little bit over 1 billion board feet of structural lumber from Europe, mostly from Scandinavia, but also from a few other European countries, Austria, Germany to a certain extent, and a few others. But I think what we're seeing is that if you look at total lumber production, softwood lumber production in the world today, it's much more than what we could probably consume. I mean, there's an excess supply, particularly here in North America. I mean, we've had fantastic housing markets for the last 4 or 5 years. I just saw the housing market, the report from the Commerce Department this morning. It's about $2.1 billion on a seasonally adjusted annual basis. I mean, it's never been that high in over 25 years. And in spite of that, we've got very low lumber prices. In fact, except for last year, a little bit of an uptick last fall, we've had lumber people in both in Canada and the U.S., I don't think they've been making very much money. And it's because you also have to consider what's going on in Russia. Russia, for some time, you know, they dropped out of the picture, but now they're reinvesting in their sawmills. They're increasing their production capacity. And most of it's going to countries that the U.S. and Canada used to export to, particularly Japan to a certain extent, the Middle East, Europe to a certain extent, and some other some Asian countries. But those markets are being taken away from us, from Russia, from some of the European countries, Scandinavia, because they're more cost competitive than we are to a large extent. So a lot more competition, and new players that are coming onto the marketplace are looking for export markets. And most of our softwood lumber markets, we're talking about commodities. And with commodities, it's really tough to make money, particularly if the market's oversupplied.
Sometimes there are disputes between countries related to imports and exports, and I understand there are multinational governmental referees, if you will, that help sort out these issues. Could you comment on some of those bodies and what their role is in helping countries resolve disputes?
Okay, I guess the most recent one, I guess, is what happened with the WTO ruling the other day. The World Trade Organization, they ruled that it was in favor of the U.S. that they could impose duties on softwood lumber from Canada, implying that the Canadian governments, the provincial governments basically, are subsidizing the Canadian forest products industry. So they supported our things that we've done over the past, imply duties or on Canadian lumber imports.
So WTO is one of those. Are there any others?
Yes, there's also what's going on right now. Canada has applied or appealed to NAFTA, North American Free Trade Organization, and there is an appeal process there where they're contesting these duties, the countervail duties imposed by the U.S.
Mm-hmm.
There's a number of ways that, in this case, Canada can apply. And these are all in the courts right now, basically. But I think what happened yesterday with the WTO ruling is that it's going to force probably or encourage the U.S. and Canada to come back to the negotiating table.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
With some sort of a solution. But there's lots of different appeal processes, and these things take just an awful long time. In fact, this process has been going on between Canada and the U.S. for 30 or 40 years.
20 years. Okay. Well, thanks, Dr. Shua. We appreciate it. Steve Guy is with the Alabama Farmers Federation. Hello, Steve.
Hello, Ace.
Steve, the voters in Alabama recently defeated a tax hike, and the governor, I think, is now looking for ways to save some money. Can you tell us about some of the ideas that are being floated?
Well, I think the message that people of Alabama sent was that they wanted accountability first before they were willing to open up their pocketbooks and consider any new taxes. I think that message was sent loud and clear.
Mm-hmm.
So the governor said he heard the message. So one of the things that he has done recently is he appointed a commission. He called it the Governor's Commission on Efficiency, Consolidation, and Funding. To look into ways that the government, our state government, could be more accountable. Our president and CEO, Jerry Newby, was appointed to that commission by Governor Riley, and I represented Mr. Newby on the Environmental and Natural Resources Subcommittee that looked into eight agencies that include Department of Conservation, Natural Resources, Department of Environmental Management, Department of Agriculture and Industries, the Forestry Commission, Surface Mining Commission, the Geological Survey of Alabama, the Oil and Gas Board, and the Liquefied Petroleum Gas Board.
Okay, and how might these agencies be affected, at least conceptually?
Well, we had each agency head come before us, and we took a look at their budgets. We got very detailed budgets, and we talked with them and asked them to give us ideas on ways that they might be able to save money. We did look at some consolidation of certain agencies. We also explored some different concepts of other states have explored, including what's called clustering. You have several in many of the state agencies, they have many of the same functions, for instance, like an accounting. Each agency has an accounting section or maybe a personnel section or a legal section, and we looked at maybe combining those and maybe one accounting section being able to serve that role for several agencies. So we looked at several concepts, innovative concepts like that, and looked at some ways that some things could be consolidated, and our report was issued last week.
Is any of this final, I think you mentioned the concept of consolidating or merging agencies, for example, the Forestry Commission, Conservation Department, and looking at ways to merge them. And that, but that's not is that a bona fide proposal on the table at this point?
Well, I think that the language in the report said that they would like to look into that concept. I think it's something that may be looked into, along with the clustering concept as well. One problem that you have in consolidating these agencies is most of them are set up under state law, and so you're looking at having to repeal state laws, and all of these agencies have their constituents that they serve, and they were set up for a reason. The clustering concept would not involve having to go the legislative route. Mm-hmm. Rather, it could be done administratively.
Mm-hmm. It's just a process. Okay.
Yeah.
Thanks, Steve.
Mm-hmm.
I appreciate you joining us.
Yes.
Every once in a while, a forest product comes along that has the potential to really shake things up, and one of the newest ones we've heard of is something called Temtec. Liam Lightly with the Mississippi State Department of Forest Products can tell us about it. Welcome, Liam.
Good morning.
What's Temtec?
Temtec is a unique new product. It's a long fiber material, that's how we describe it, produced from plantations of either fast-grown softwoods or hardwoods. So we're looking at what we refer to as stems of 3 to 8 inch diameter, and if you can imagine, that stem is crushed, and the crushing causes long fibers to be produced, and those fibers are then formed into a beam type of structure and stuck together and pressed in a steam press. And so what we get out at the end is a long beam. And this beam basically is a high-value product which has come from low-value, small-diameter stems.
What would this beam be used for? It sounds like it's would compare with a dimensional lumber product.
Yeah, one area that we were just looking at last week would be a typical header in a garage structure. That would be a common one. We believe that other end uses that we see engineered wood products being used for in residential and commercial construction are good targets for the TimTech beams.
Mm-hmm. Well, you mentioned it uses fast-grown wood, which is an issue in the lumber market. The quality of the wood that's being produced under more intensive forest management sounds like this could be a market for more intensively grown wood.
Exactly, and we see that there are limited markets for landowners to sell, especially the first thinnings from pine plantations. And so we could use that type of material, fast-grown, high content of juvenile wood, low strength characteristics. We could use that material by reforming it into the beams, which is referred to as the TimTech product.
When are we going to see it at Home Depot?
We believe that there are strong interests in Mississippi to take up and commercialize the product. We would then need to have plants created, and we're hopeful that the first plant will be turning the key this time next year.
Oh, okay.
So there's strong interest from local industry.
All right. Thanks, Liam.
Thank you.
Dr. Tom Chestnut is with the Alabama Cooperative Extension System. Hello, Tom.
Hello.
Tom, you've been promoting agrotourism, and for those who this term is not familiar, could you just explain what it is?
Sure, be happy to. We've got four agencies working together on this, organizations, and so we wanted to make sure we were all on the same page. And so for our purposes, we took a pretty industry standard model. We defined it as a commercial enterprise at any agricultural operation that provides activities for the enjoyment of visitors that helps generate income for the owner. And by an agricultural operation, we're talking about a farmer, agribusiness, horticulture operation, anything along that line. The activities can be, you know, very varied, from farm visits, farm stays, UPIC operations, on-farm sales, off-farm sales, such as farmers markets, and then fee hunting and fee fishing are definitely a part of this as well.
The enjoyment of visitors you mentioned, and how would a visitor access an agricultural operation? How you suppose it could be packaged?
So mentioned there are four agencies working together, us and Extension, and we're working with Farmers Federation, the Alabama Department of Ag and Industries, and then the Alabama Bureau of Tourism and Travel. We're developing what we call an agritourism trail, and it would be a website, alabamaagritourism.com. It's mostly up right now except for the trail part of it because we're trying to get people to sign on to be listed. And so that's part of our responsibilities, Ag and Industries and Farmers Federation, is to get the word out there so we can get people to sign on to the trail. And then in about a month, we're going to activate the trail portion of the website where the traveler could come on there, say type in alabamaagritourism.com, and they can choose geographically, say the Wiregrass area, the Northeast area, and see what's up there, or they can choose by category, say I want to do on-farm sales, educational activities, or it can be a combination of both. They can say, okay, I want to go to the Northwest, what UPIC operations are there.
Okay. In order to help you connect the dots that you're connecting there for the trail, how does one get listed on this trail?
Two ways. The easiest thing and quickest way is to get onto the website, alabamaagritourism.com, if I haven't said it often enough yet. Mm-hmm. And the first thing on the homepage there is how to be listed. And so click on that, and it will take you through step by step of putting your site onto the web. The other is, and we prefer that because it's quicker, it's going to be more accurate because the owner's actually putting in the information. If they don't have access to the web for some reason, they can let us know. We'll send them a paper form, send it back to us, and we'll enter it. It will take longer. And photographs or pictures, either in print or email or that format, we really like to have those so we can show the people what the site looks like.
Okay. Thank you. We appreciate you joining us.
Oh, and the cost, the cost is reasonable. It's free.
Okay, that's the best news of all.
Okay.
Our next guest is Bill Hubbard. He's been instrumental in delivering forestry education to the masses through the Master Tree Farmer program. Hello, Bill.
Good morning.
For those who are not familiar with the Master Tree Farmer program, can you just describe the concept for us again?
Sure, Hayes. About 4 or 5 years ago, a number of us got together and realized that there's a huge need for just an introductory forest management course, and that combined with the technology that we all have and all the way down to the county level and the interest in working together, we created a satellite-based course that can be downlinked really to any place in the South Country world that has a commercial satellite dish.
All right, so it's really easy. It sounds like it's really easy to access. And would you have to have any sort of introductory level of knowledge before you participated in something like that?
No, we've actually designed three different courses for various audiences and various interest levels. The introductory Master Tree Farmer program, which begins February 3rd, will be downlinked. Currently, we have about 65 sites out across the country. That will be downlinked to anybody that would have just a real general interest and about forest management. We go through introduction to forestry terms and concepts. We'll go through an introduction to basic forest finance, investments, taxation, estate planning. We'll talk about introduction to pine management, introduction to hardwood management. We'll dabble a little bit into wildlife management. We'll look at marketing and selling your timber. We'll look at some current forestry issues that are affecting private forest landowners, and we'll look at forestry services available to landowners.
I'll bet you've developed an archive over the years, because y'all have been doing this for several years, of information that really a landowner could just go to the web and access. Is that right?
That's true. In fact, we have used the Internet to stream all the courses that we've conducted live over the past 3 years, beginning with Master Tree Farmer 2001, and so there are 21 hours of video separated into smaller, more digestible chunks.
Right.
We've got the videos. All you need is internet access and the free Reel player, which you can download at reel.com, I believe, and so you can watch the Master Tree Farmer 1. You can watch the advanced level, and you can watch Master Wildlifer. We also have the notebook materials, PowerPoint presentations, and other materials that the speakers have used. So you could do that, or there's also a way to order the tapes from Clemson, and Clemson's acted as the host over the years.
All right. Well, thank you for reminding us of that, Bill. We appreciate it. Is Jenny Jones with us?
Uh-huh. I made it.
Yes. It's good to have you with us.
Okay, thank you.
Jenny, AFOA has always been interested in reaching out to those who use land to practice a sport or hobby but don't necessarily want to be tree farmers.
Mm-hmm.
And you're one of those people. You're a bird expert by profession, and you're on the faculty at Mississippi State University. I wanted you to tell us a little bit about how non-game birds react to changes in the place that they live. Is there some sort of connection when their habitat is manipulated and how they live and whether they're attracted to a particular place?
Oh, definitely. They're, you know, birds and wildlife are just like us. They go where the food and the comfort of cover is. So they do. Landowners can really determine what kind of groups of birds and species of birds that are going to be there occupying their land by how they manage their forest and their openings. So, you know, open, younger age class forest will have certain suites of birds or assemblages of birds, whereas the older age class forest will support the forest land birds, you know, like the nuthatches and things like that that are in the older age class pines. And then hardwoods, for example, will support a lot of our more small forest dwelling birds like warblers and wood thrushes and things like that. So landowners can manipulate what's out there by managing their habitat, definitely.
Give us an idea. You've mentioned certain categories of forest, but mm-hmm. could you tell us things that landowners could do that would change the species composition?
Oh, yes, definitely. And that's one of the things we really enjoy working with landowners on over here, and that includes public land managers as well as private lands people. You know, a lot of times we do active management for white-tailed deer and for turkey because they're important game species. But, for example, a lot of the same management, for example, clover plantings and early successional food plots will really attract things like bluebirds. If you do have cavity nesting birds around, like bluebirds, nest boxes, placement of those and including predator guards on those box poles is important to support cavity nesting birds like bluebirds. In our pine upland pine forest, where we might implement prescribed fire for supporting game species like deer and northern bobwhite quail, this will also benefit a lot of the grassland sparrow species. If it's open enough, meadowlarks will be attracted. So a lot of non-game birds will come to those areas they would prescribe fire.
Mm-hmm.
Shrub plantings, and we really like to recommend either retaining native shrubs or maybe even planting shrubs that produce fruit, things like wild plum. Chickasaw plum is an example, the native vacciniums or native blueberries. And then the hawthorns are also very good fruit producers that attract a whole array of birds for nesting cover, but also for important foods that they get from the fruit.
Let me ask you this. You're talking about habitat manipulation and things that landowners do. Is this an idea, or is anybody actually doing this on their own private land I'm talking about?
Oh, yes. For one, I'm doing it. Mm-hmm. I like to try to practice what I preach. Mm-hmm. So I do own forest land, and I have some old fields that I retain as openings. And so we have a lot of kind of show-and-tell demonstration projects that we have on the ground here in Mississippi. I know of resource managers that are also doing it in Alabama and Georgia and up through South Carolina and North Carolina as well. So we have a lot of private lands managers that are doing this kind of management, whether it's prescribed fire in their upland pines, gap selection or group selection cuts to increase soft mass production in vines and shrubs in their forest lands, and also, you know, plantings of shrubs and placement of nest boxes. We have that ongoing, and
right.
So it's neat.
All right. Thanks, Jenny.
Yeah, okay.
Our next guest is a landowner who recently published an article in Tree Farmer magazine about making a timber sale. His name is Don East. Hello, Don.
Hello there, Hayes.
Don, tell us how a landowner goes about making this decision first to sell timber. What thoughts should go through his mind?
Well, basically, we should look at it like this. If a private landowner that is not accustomed to making timber sales or decides to make a sale, the first thing he's got to do is decide if he's going to make the sale himself or herself, or if they're going to use the services of a consulting forester.
Mm-hmm.
And the way to make that decision is, how much time do you have and how much experience do you have? Let's say you have a full-time job, you've got no prior experience in conducting a timber sale, and no time to study up on the subject, then you probably should employ a consulting forester to handle the sale. Most consulting foresters charge about 7-10% of the take for their service, and it's tax deductible as expense of sale.
Mm-hmm. So that's the first decision you make. I know that sometimes we learn by making mistakes. Could you comment on some of the mistakes that you would like to see landowners avoid if they're going to make a timber sale?
I suppose the most common error that the average private forest landowner makes when conducting a timber sale is not thinking the entire process through before they start. And by this I mean they should think about several questions, such as, what are you going to do with the property after the harvest is over? Are you going to reforest it? Are you going to convert it to pasture land or some other use, mm-hmm. or subdivision? Do you want to enhance the wildlife aspects of the tract afterwards? By thinking of things like these and other points before you even begin to market the timber, then you can make some better decisions relative to the type of harvest, to the location, of the roads and loading decks that you're going to put on a property, the location of stream crossings, the unique trees to be marked and left uncut, historic sites or sensitive sites to work around, wildflower areas to be excluded, and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
But if you don't think the entire process through before you start, then things will be done during a harvest that are not reversible and cost you money and grief later on. Sort of like the old carpenter saying, like measure and mark twice and cut once.
Do you see any wisdom in using a consultant as a general rule?
Yes, like I say, if you don't have the time to do it and you don't have the experience, and because a timber sale can be the largest sum of money that an individual will get at one time in their lifetime, and you ought to consider it very seriously because, you know, if you pay 7-10% to that consulting forester, he's going to handle it, and it's up to him to get the most money, and it's his benefit to get the most money. So he's going to do you a good job, and also it's tax deductible, so it's an expensive sale. So,
right.
So if you don't have the qualifications and you don't have the time to get smart before you do a timber sale, you ought to seriously consider consulting forester.
All right. Thanks, Don. Well, that's all the time we have for this issue. Our thanks go to Mary O'Grady, Al Schuler, Steve Guy, and Liam Lightly. Thanks also to Tom Chestnut, Bill Hubbard, Jenny Jones, and Don East. It's useful to remember that America is poised toward the northern end of the Americas. Many of our neighbors to the south have different regard for property rights than we, and also different regard for capital formation. Property ownership is undoubtedly something that we take for granted, but it's clearly the foundation for our system of economics. Many countries have abundant natural resources, but a weak system of private property. Some have little natural resources. The U.S. is blessed to be strong in both, and as long as this continues to be the case, we'll continue to be a leader in the world economy. On behalf of the Alabama Forest Owners Association, I'm Hayes Brown, thanking you for joining us for this issue of Capital Ideas Live.